You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the U.S. is ranked number 19 on this year's World Happiness Report. That's the lowest we've been on the list since it was created back in 2012. We'll talk to an economist who says our addictive society might be bringing our happiness down. Now it's time for our weekly Wisconsin News Roundup. We check in with reporters around the state about the stories they're covering. First, racist and anti-Semitic photos that allegedly involved UW Oshkosh students have circulated on social media. Today, the school is responding. Chancellor Andrew Leavitt held a community forum this afternoon to address the issue. Lydia Slattery is the Streetwise reporter for the Oshkosh Northwestern. Lydia, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, great to be here.
Well, Lydia, we've been hearing about the pictures in our news breaks today, but you were at this forum held at UW Oshkosh. What kind of things were you hearing, first of all, from the chancellor and UW Oshkosh administration?
So obviously the administration disavowed the photos and said this is not what UW Oshkosh stands for. They want to foster a welcoming community. But this is the second forum they have had in 2 months after another racist incident.
And what kind of things did you hear? Were students speaking at this meeting? And if so, what did they have to say?
Yeah, so basically students were invited to speak and then they passed around the microphone. And a lot of students, you know, they spoke, they were shocked and absolutely horrified by these photos, but they don't feel that, you know, simply asking these students to leave is enough. They want the students reprimanded more, possibly even expelled. But as the chancellor pointed out, you cannot expel someone for free speech, even if it is hate speech.
Apart from dealing with the students themselves who may have posted these pictures, what kind of things are people in the university community talking about in response to this event and the one that you mentioned earlier in March related to a student government election?
So the student government election, a Snapchat photo was going around that said, don't vote for a Hmong and a lesbian. And obviously students got upset and the university held a similar forum. And I wasn't there. It was another reporter, Davy Shastri, who now works for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She was there, and, you know, people obviously at this forum were just they're very upset because they feel like they need more to be done than just having forums. They need to reach out to the people who don't go to the forums.
All right. And what are you looking for next on this story as the students and the administration react?
I guess I'm looking what the investigation will bring up. They weren't able to release any details because it is ongoing, but, you know, social media has been ablaze, you know, people but have really gone to the defense of, you know, the marginalized students, and they've tried to stick together.
We'll leave it there. Lydia, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
That's Lydia Slattery, reporter for the Oshkosh Northwestern. She was with us to talk about the response from UW Oshkosh to racist social media posts that allegedly involve students. Monday at 7, Chancellor Andrew Leavitt from UW Oshkosh will join the morning show to talk about what's ahead for the school and the community there. Now, Buffalo County in western Wisconsin is getting attention in the hunting community after its Deer Advisory Council voted to recommend a ban on buck hunting for the 2019 season, a doe-only hunt. That plan now goes to the DNR for approval. Paul Smith is the outdoors editor for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Paul, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rob.
Well, buck hunting, you write, is a big deal for Buffalo County. So why is the Deer Advisory Council saying 2019 should be an antlerless hunting season?
Yeah, the local group there, it's known as a Deer Advisory Council in Buffalo County, has set a deer population goal of decrease. Each county in the state has one of these, what we call CDACs, County Deer Advisory Councils, and they set these three-year population objectives. 20 counties around the state have set this decrease objective. Where they see, by all the data, that the deer population is too high. And in Buffalo County, they met last week and gave a final recommendation that was shocking to many people, as they used what is considered the most severe tool at their disposal, and that was a recommendation for an antlerless-only season. that antlerless deer, that means does or female deer, and they're the key to the population. It's especially controversial because this is in Buffalo County, which many people in North America travel to each year to hunt for big trophy bucks.
Talk about the response. I mean, you even wrote about death threats to people on this council.
Well, yes, two county councils in the last 4 years have recommended a preliminary recommendation of antlerless only hunts. That was in Waupaca County in 2016 and in Door County in 2017. And some of those members of the local CDEX, now these are local residents who are voluntarily serving on these councils. They're not paid, and they're members of the community, received death threats, reported death threats. We don't know that they've been received in Buffalo County, but it is very controversial. And that tells you something about how seriously people take deer hunting. It's big business. It's part of our culture. And controversy is not new related to deer management.
You write that there was a successful program that's been used in Wisconsin that isn't on the table anymore, the Earn a Buck program. Talk about what that is and why it's not out there anymore.
Yes, the Earn a Buck program was formerly used in Wisconsin, and what it, as the name implies, a hunter would have to earn the right to shoot a buck by shooting a doe or an antlerless deer. So a hunter would shoot a doe, would register it, and then get an authorization to shoot a buck. It worked. It really was the most effective tool in our state's history at reducing deer numbers. However, there was some opposition, and it gained momentum through 2008-2009 timeframe. And in 2011, the legislature actually took it up and prohibited it. So in state law, it's now prohibited. It's not at the disposal of these CDEX as a tool. So this local group in Buffalo County they would have preferred to vote for Earn a Buck if they could, but it's not on the table. And they went to this antlerless only season, which really nobody really likes it.
We'll leave it there and watch what happens, Paul. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you, Rob.
Paul Smith is the outdoors editor for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He was with us to talk about Buffalo County's Deer Advisory Council recommending an antlerless hunt this year. The DNR still has to weigh in on that plan during its May 22nd meeting in Madison. Lastly, Milwaukee is seeing a surge in police chases after a policy change a couple years ago. Some of those chases have been fatal. Corrine Hess is WPR's reporter based in Milwaukee. Corey, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Rob.
Well, let's go back to 2017 when the Milwaukee's Police and Fire Commission changed their policy on high-speed pursuits. What changed?
Well, the former Chief Flynn had limited the times when police could chase. And in 2017, the Police and Fire Commission unanimously voted to allow chases for reckless drivers and drug dealers.
And what have we seen in the numbers now of police chases since that that change came about?
A study just came out that showed a 155% increase. So in the last year, well, from 2017 to 2018, there's just been a huge jump. So last year in 2018, there were 940 police chases, and there are about 370 in 2017.
And this all comes out after a couple of deadly chases in the last couple of weeks in Milwaukee. Can you tell us a little bit about those?
Sure. In April, there were several high-speed chases, and most of those did have to do with reckless vehicles, and there were two fatalities.
And are people raising concerns now saying maybe we need to push back in the other direction, reverse the policy again, given safety concerns?
You know, it's really, it's kind of a no-win situation. I mean, having these reckless vehicles on the road is equally dangerous, but then the police chases are dangerous. So people are raising concerns. The police department has said they're not going to change their policy. Several city aldermen have come out and said that the policy should not be changed, but there are some advocacy groups that believe that it should be changed.
Corey, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date.
Thank you.
That's Corrine Hess, WPR's Milwaukee reporter, with us to talk about a rise in police chases in the city and to wrap up our look at news stories from around the state. The U.S. is number 19 on the annual ranking by the World Happiness Report. We're just behind Belgium, and the Czech Republic is just behind us. Our Canadian neighbors come in at number 9, by the way. By some measures, from the years 1946 to 1970, happiness levels remained unchanged despite rising incomes and wealth. So what is it that's pushing us to unhappiness today? Our next guest has an idea. Jeffrey Sachs is university professor and director for sustainable development at Columbia University. He's an economist, author, and editor of numerous books and a global leader in sustainable development. He wrote Chapter 7 of the World Happiness Report called Addiction and Unhappiness in America. Jeffrey, thanks a lot for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Before we get into the importance of addiction as part of this story, can you talk about this growing attempt to measure happiness, not just economic productivity, but happiness in countries around the world?
Well, as your story mentioned, already it's 30 years ago when Professor Richard Easterlin at University of Pennsylvania noted that our incomes are rising, but our happiness is not rising. That was more than 30 years ago. It has not only remained the case in the United States, but incomes continued to go up, but unhappiness actually has also gone up in this case. In other words, Americans are less happy than they were. And yet, what do we watch every day? Did the gross domestic product go up? We don't pay attention to the fact that our well-being, our sense of life satisfaction is declining in this country. And indeed, we're seeing other measures that show our worry, our anxieties, our anger is rising. America's one of the most worried societies in the whole world, according to data that Gallup just published recently on emotions around the world. I think it's very concerning for the United States.
And you wrote that chapter for this edition of the World Happiness Report, looking at addiction in the United States. And people might go to a drug addiction, opioid addiction. You're looking more broadly than that. We are kind of, we have addictive personalities, it sounds like, in the United States.
Well, I think we have addictive tendencies, partly because we have an unregulated business sector, for example, the fast food industry, which has fought against any regulation that stops them or would stop them from addicting us with very unhealthy foods that have contributed now to the highest obesity rate in the entire world. We have, of course, an online epidemic of addictions, of gaming, of video, of the time that young people are spending on screens, which is absolutely shocking, actually, averaging 8 hours a day for adolescent groups, according to recent data. We have an opioid epidemic in part because we had really disgusting behavior by pharmaceutical companies that were giving paybacks to doctors to prescribe painkillers that the company knew to be addictive. Now we have an epidemic in this country. We have soaring numbers of suicides. And again, to a significant extent, it is about corporate behavior that has been winked at by the political class, which takes money from these corporations. So I don't think it's an American personality per se. I think we probably share personalities with the rest of the world. But I do think it is a political environment that is toxic to well-being right now.
So how do you start to turn something like that around?
One good way to do it is to look at the countries that are consistently much happier than the United States. In this year's ranking, it's Finland, Denmark, Norway, Iceland, Netherlands, Switzerland, Sweden, New Zealand, Canada, and Austria, rounding out the top 10. And all of those countries reduce stress levels in society because they guarantee health care. They don't pile up massive debts on the backs of students. They take care of the poor. They don't leave people struggling the way that American society does right now. And they don't have a political culture, which is really a fear-mongering culture, the way President Trump and his ilk lead us right now. And I think that this is also raising the stress in American society, because confidence in government has plummeted, understandably. Confidence in each other has plummeted. So we've become a very hard-edged, rather nasty place compared to the places that are kinder and softer and happier.
Talking to Jeffrey Sachs from Columbia University. He's an economist and author. We're looking at happiness around the world and declining happiness, apparently, in the United States. He says addiction in various forms is driving our unhappiness in part. Jeffrey, what you were just talking about, I mean, there is definitely an attitude, a celebrated idea, of course, of the American individual, the rugged individual. It's up to us to make our own way and figure out our own happiness that I think is leads some people, some politicians, to be suspicious of what you're talking about, the idea that at the government level, they should be focused on our individual happiness.
I don't trust those politicians for a moment. They're on the take. What I observe happening in Washington is massive corruption, politicians taking billions of dollars from corporate interests, whether it's the NRA or whether it's big oil or whether it's Wall Street. They may parrot the idea of individualism, but what they're really doing is acting out a corrupt practice, and they leave industries that are doing great harm to the American people, massively overcharging for medicines or addicting Americans with medicines through this kind of kickback. They just turn their eyes away. Then they tell us about don't be like Europe, but actually it's the European countries that are much happier, that have much less stress in the society, that have a much healthier work-life balance. So these politicians may talk a good game, but I think that they're basically on the corporate take.
So as you're painting the system there, it sounds like there's no way to improve things. If the system is that flawed and corrupt, what would be a prescription to making the changes that would make individuals happier?
We do need to change the system, and I think the only way it's going to be changed is by voting for politicians that say they're not going to take corporate money. Because I do think fundamentally we are trapped right now with a kind of economic system which caters to the super rich, which caters to the big corporate lobbies, and which pays the politicians to do their bidding. And it's leading to epidemics. It's leading to poor health in our society. We actually have falling life expectancy in the United States, if you can imagine that. A rich country like ours that spends twice as much as any other country in the world on healthcare because of the jacked up healthcare prices, and our life expectancy has declined 2 years in a row. What can we do about it? We can elect politicians that are not corrupted by corporate money. I think this is really going to be our only solution.
There is a lot of advice and information out there that tackles each of the problems that you're talking about as far as various forms of addiction as an individual issue, as something for people to solve themselves. Do you think that is part of the story, that people need to be aware of, whether it's an online addiction, a fast food addiction, or what have you? Is there some individual responsibility that could end up collectively helping us all?
I think awareness by people of how others are trying to addict them, how fast foods are trying to addict them, how the drug industry has trapped them, how the online industry uses all sorts of devices to try to keep their eyes on the screen, because that's what allows the advertising revenues to be hyped. That is important. Of course, in our own lives, we have to try as best we can to live lives that don't get ourselves trapped into these addictions. But this is a social phenomenon. It is not the sum of individual Americans that just suddenly became addicted to opioids. This is something that goes beyond that. It is not just that Americans suddenly became the most obese society in the world, far and away above the other high-income countries. This is something about our politics and about how our society is running. And you are completely right that it comes under this veneer of individualism, but that's phony, and it is a corporate ploy.
All right, so it all sounds really gloomy. Do you feel any sense of optimism here, Jeffrey, in our last minute or so?
I do, because I travel around the world to places that are actually happier and doing fine, and I see that it's completely within our reach. And Canada is an example of that. Northern Europe are good examples. What we need to do is to understand, as we enter this new political cycle, why we are trapped by hate-mongering politicians and by corrupt politicians on the take, and how we can get out of it. Fortunately, we have a democracy. We can vote for a system that reduces the stress levels that average Americans are facing.
We'll leave it there. Jeffrey, thanks for joining us today.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
That's Jeffrey Sachs, University Professor and Director for Sustainable Development at Columbia University. He's an economist and author. He's joined us to talk about how addictions are affecting happiness here in the United States. The field of Democratic candidates running for president is now at 20, with former Vice President Joe Biden getting in this week. He made it official yesterday in an online video focusing on the violence at an August 2017 white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia.
I believe history will look back on 4 years of this president and all he embraces as an aberrant moment in time. But if we give Donald Trump 8 years in the White House, he will forever and fundamentally alter the character of this nation, who we are. And I cannot stand by and watch that happen.
A Politico Morning Consult poll this week has Biden leading the Democratic field. It also has him ahead of Trump, 42-34%. So where does the race go from here? Mordecai Lee is a professor of urban planning at UW-Milwaukee and a former state lawmaker. Mordecai, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Rob.
Well, with 20 candidates, what is a voter to do? How do you start to sort out who is pulling for what, where they are on the issues, who you like as a candidate? This is a challenge for voters, right?
Well, you know, I think it's wonderful. It's like walking into 31 flavors and just sort of being delighted by the choices that you've got. You know, some voters choose to vote for somebody who they just sort of intuitively like. Some voters like to vote for a candidate who, let's say, they're ideologically compatible with. There are all these different cross-cutting criteria, and there's no one criteria that's right or wrong. And so I think for voters in the Democratic primary, it'll just be a delight that they can just sort of taste the field and find somebody that they're a perfect fit for.
And before we get into some of the particulars in this race, with a big field like this, what do you look for from the media in trying to let voters know who's out there, who they are, and what they stand for?
Oh, Rob, that's the $68,000 question, and it's the perfect question. Because the media so blundered in the Republican primary for president last time around, giving so much exposure to Trump and essentially ignoring everybody else. My sort of suggestion, partly tongue-in-cheek, is that we ban reporters from ever saying polls show, and we ban reporters from ever saying the horse race looks like. In other words, let's have some traditional journalism where every candidate gets treated equally, not with a kind of a top tier versus a kids table, or so-and-so raised X million of dollars in 24 hours, and that means that he or she is at the top of the field.
What do you want to see instead of that, though? That's the don't do list. What kind of stuff do you want to see us do?
Oh, God, you're a persistent reporter.
I'm going to take notes here, Mordecai. Tell me my job here and all of us.
Well, I mean, the easy problem is that if you've got 20 candidates and you want to do a substantive piece on how do they feel about Medicare for all, you have to do 20 segments. You have to do 20 paragraphs. I mean, I suppose you could do a shorthand version of it. So in these number of candidates, and then you name them, say they're for Medicare for all including abolishing private health insurance, whereas these people want to talk about expanding access to private health insurance coverage. There's got to be a way to do some generalizations, but sometimes it seems like political reporters just hate substance. They hate policy. They're bored by public policy, and that they're always looking for excuses not to cover things. And I'll just mention one candidate. I think Elizabeth Warren is a very interesting candidate in the sense that she's put together some very unusual and cutting-edge policy proposals. And, you know, I'm not endorsing her. I'm not trying to give her favorable coverage. But, you know, when she talks about what to do about Facebook or what to do about Apple, I think that deserves attention and for us to know how the other candidates feel about those kinds of issues.
That reminds me, one concern people have raised is there's been a lot of focus on Joe Biden even before I get into the race. Bernie Sanders, of course, Beto O'Rourke, Pete Buttigieg, getting a lot of attention. People are saying, wait a minute, a lot of the guys in this race are getting a lot of the headlines and the women not as much, even though they may have higher profiles coming into the race, even they may have more developed policy platforms. Do you see that?
I sort of see it. I think Senator Harris from California got a bit of a bump when she declared and got a bit of a distinctive coverage. Maybe if we go back to other races where there were big fields, sometimes there's almost like a flavor of the month, you know, a kind of a, who's the hot candidate this month? And in a sense, there's nothing wrong with it as long as everybody gets to share in the attention, as long as every candidate sooner or later gets to be flavor of the month. But I'm sure that some of these candidates will flame out. Some of the candidates just seem like they're such long shots that it's hard to believe that they would break through. But on the other hand, Jimmy Carter was the Jimmy Who when he ran for president, and he eventually got the Democratic nomination in that case and got elected president. So we shouldn't poo-poo the lesser names. And I'm glad that the DNC is not going to do a kind of adults table, kids table for the debates, but rather we'll do like two debates back-to-back, night-to-night, with all the candidates having a chance being either in the first or the second.
Talking to Mordecai Lee from UW-Milwaukee, former state lawmaker, about the big field of Democratic candidates. Well, Joe Biden is the big news right now. He just got into the race. He was a heartbeat away from the presidency for 8 years there. What does he bring to the table when it comes to policies and ideology within the Democratic Party?
Well, I suppose we would describe Biden as sort of an old-fashioned Democrat in the sense that he comes from that old coalition of labor and liberals. Where it was labor unions, blue-collar, white ethnics, together with sort of liberal activists who sort of dominated the party and really dominated the nominating process for all those years. So I guess he harkens back to that era, and in the sense that he did come from a blue-collar family. He grew up in blue-collar Pennsylvania. Gives him some of those credentials. He apparently is very good with people. He's very comfortable around people. People like him. But on the other hand, maybe it's a kind of a absence makes the heart grow fonder in the sense of that he hasn't been on the scene for 4 years. And so his positives are way up compared to when he was vice president, thinking about running for president. And his negatives and his positives were, as I recall, tied. I think it was like 39-39. So it's really hard to judge these mood swings of the voters. And so hard to judge. Here we are 9 months before the first votes will be cast in Iowa and New Hampshire, that anything can happen. That's an eternity in political time.
Now, President Trump spent a good amount of time with Sean Hannity of Fox News last night. He was asked about Joe Biden getting into the race. Here's a listen.
Well, I think we're calling him Sleepy Joe because I've known him for a while, and he's a pretty sleepy guy. He's not going to be able to deal with President Xi, I will tell you. That's a different level of energy and, frankly, intelligence.
Now, Mordecai, in that crowded Republican field, candidate Donald Trump did seem to have a knack to label his opponents in one simple derogatory way, and it seemed like make it stick. Is that something that can work for him with this, you know, trying to do it cross-party in a crowded Democratic field?
Well, he's a marvelous showman. I mean, you just sort of have to watch him because you never know what's the next thing that's going to come out of his mouth. And he's very entertaining, really brings show business to the White House. But I'm not sure if that'll stick. Some of when he described one of the candidates, I think it was Jeb Bush's low energy. I think that was unreasonable, but the media loved it. And so the media repeated it until it became a self-fulfilling prophecy. And just from afar, I'm not sure that anybody has an impression that Joe Biden is low energy or lazy or slow or whatever it might be. For a guy to be a U.S. senator and then to be vice president, you can't be the way Trump is trying to describe him. And I don't think we should let the president of one party really make a caricature stick to a candidate from the other party until it's down to a one-on-one race.
And I want to spend a few moments on the idea of not just a Democratic primary field. There is talk of a Republican primary challenge. There is a Republican primary challenge. William Weld, a former governor, former Libertarian vice presidential candidate. There's talk of some higher profile candidates, Larry Hogan from Maryland, John Kasich from Ohio. What do you think could happen? What would you watch for if there were a more a substantial primary challenge to the president?
Well, I think that's relatively unlikely to be significant. After all, for example, 1972, President Nixon was running for re-election, and he had two opponents, one challenging him from the right and one challenging him from the left, and they just went nowhere. And the Republican Party, and generally speaking, parties in America, will defer to an incumbent. I mean, unless you have a situation of, like, Lyndon Johnson, who probably, had he stayed in the race, would have been defeated for the nomination, I think it's very unlikely that modern-day politics, especially modern-day Republican politics, would really have any appeal going in that direction. So I think we should assume that by the time we get to the primaries, and especially by the time we get to the Wisconsin primary in April, so a year from now, that all the action will be on the Democratic side. And given that we have an open primary, I think by then all the voters are going to want to vote in the Democratic primary, because it's hard to believe there'd be a substantial Republican primary.
We're talking about the 2020 race for president and the growing field of Democratic candidates with Mordecai Lee from UW-Milwaukee. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're looking to vote for a Democrat, which one do you most support and why? Do you focus on where they stand on issues, your thoughts on their leadership, their conduct, their composure, their past? If you are a Republican, is there a candidate that worries you who you think would be a formidable opponent for President Trump? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the 2020 race for president with Mordecai Lee, professor of urban planning at UW-Milwaukee and former state lawmaker. We've got this growing Democratic field, former Vice President Joe Biden now officially part of it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are you looking for in a candidate if you were thinking of voting in the Democratic primary a year from now-ish? What are you looking for? Is there an issue that's going to motivate you? Is there a element of character that motivates you to pick a Republican or a Democrat, for that matter? And what kind of questions do you want to hear answered by candidates for president? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. John is with us in Appleton. John, hi.
Yeah, the question I have is, where do all these people go on climate change? And why, when you have increasing interest in this issue with all the fires, that when you have a candidate like Governor Jay Inslee of Washington State, who, you know, he has a background in the state legislature, U.S. House of Representatives, as state house governor, and he's, you know, a decade or more focusing on this issue, and it's like the press has this whole primary system. The press covers what the rest of the press is covering. They don't go out and try to provide a broader picture.
John, thanks a lot for calling. Yeah, Governor Inslee making climate change the central issue of his campaign. And Mordecai, I remember people after the elections last year looked back at the presidential debates and found very little or no questions about climate change in most of those debates. Do you think, Mordecai, this is going to be an issue that gets more focus this time around?
Well, I'm so glad that John called, because John is the perfect example of how the big Democratic field is a good thing for voters. John happens to be somebody who really cares about climate change. That's his number one issue. So he's got a candidate who's saying that it's his number one issue. So that's a perfect fit. I'm guessing that most of the Democratic candidates have relatively mainstream views about climate change, in the same way that Republican candidates have a relatively consensus position of the Republican Party against climate change. But the fact that Governor Inslee stands out, I think there are going to be Johns all around America who are going to rally around him, just like there are going to be other people with other number one issues rallying around the other 19 candidates.
And if I may reference polling, Mordecai, I think I've seen some polling that suggests that younger generations, millennial voters, for example, climate change tends to rank higher as an issue for them. Do you see that maybe as part of a Democratic effort at younger voter outreach?
There's no doubt that various policy platform issues can appeal to sort of different demographics, whether we're talking about dividing them by age or by geography, by ethnicity, whatever it might be. But either way, there is a consensus position on climate change for each party. And so can Governor Inslee break out with that one issue? Can he create a network of citizen activists in the states with the early primaries so that he can break out, or at least that he can then stay alive as the field is shaking out so that then he can be a contender later on? That's going to be the dynamic essentially for most of the candidates. They've got their marketing plan, to put it blandly and blankly, but the question is, will it work? In other words, is the younger generation going to hear his message, in this case about climate change, and will they vote for him, and maybe otherwise they would not have voted at all?
Thanks a lot for that call, John, at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Rob with us in Monroe. Rob, hello. Rob, are you there?
Yeah, I'm there.
All right.
How you doing?
Yeah, what did you want to bring up, Rob? Rob? Okay, I'm not sure what's going on with Rob there. Mordecai, let's talk about what's going to be a big issue for Democrats and whoever ends up being the Democratic challenger to President Trump, how they talk about President Trump. We heard that clip from Joe Biden there earlier, definitely making President Trump a key issue for him in the race. What do you expect to see when it comes to targeting the president versus, their own policy platforms trying to present a positive image of themselves?
Well, I think it's going to come down to whoever the final nominee is, if they're hot or cold when they talk about Trump. In other words, are they as hot in their rhetoric of their disdain for him at a comparable level and comparable vocabulary the way he tends to communicate? Or will they be relatively cool about it? They won't get provoked. They won't get into any arguments. They won't get into a kind of a he said, she said, but rather the fact that they're not Trump would be enough for them to appeal to that part of the Democratic electorate.
We're talking to Mordecai Lee, professor at UW-Milwaukee, former state lawmaker, looking at the 2020 presidential race, the growing Democratic field, and how they will sort themselves out. Still time for you to join in, if you'd like, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from Michael on the Facebook page, Mordecai. He writes, it will be interesting to watch the debates. Curious to see each candidate's platform. How important, Mordecai, do you think the debates will be? And you mentioned there's no kids table at this one. How important are those going to be for candidates who are trying to stand out from the pack?
Well, I think it's the opportunity of a lifetime kind of situation that a guy, a voter like Michael can see all of the candidates within two nights, all being asked a question about, fill in the blank, climate change, President Trump, impeachment, Medicare for all, whatever the issue might be. And I don't think citizens have any trouble deciding who they like and who they don't like. So I think the debates, as Michael is hinting, will really make a difference, will really help candidates present themselves to the undecided primary voters.
Thanks for sending that in, Michael. Mordecai, in this Democratic field, we've got a former vice president, sitting U.S. senators, members of Congress, governors, mayors, a couple of mayors. That's a pretty wide range of experiences there. Do we have a sense of what background, what resume tends to lend itself to a Democratic candidate?
You know, there used to be a conventional wisdom that being a U.S. senator was a great platform to run for president. You know, John F. Kennedy was a U.S. senator. But if you look back, generally speaking, in American political history, being a governor has more often than not been a helpful platform, because a governor has executive experience. A governor has an experience that's very different from a U.S. senator. A U.S. senator just votes on bills and makes statements on the floor of the Senate. And so it's possible that governors will have an advantage because they'll be able to say to the voters, I know how to do this. Look at what I did in my state. But nonetheless, this is just so hard to predict. I think it's anybody's race to win and anybody's race to lose.
All right. So 20 candidates on the Democratic side, Mordecai, and I've checked my math a couple times here. 0% of them are from Wisconsin. Now, we've had Scott Walker run for president. We had Paul Ryan on the ticket for vice president. Why are we not seeing national figures emerge running for president from here in Wisconsin? That's my curveball for you today.
Yeah, I wasn't prepared for that one. I think it's just the serendipity of politics, in the sense of that there was a moment in time when sort of the stars aligned and Governor Walker was viewed as a serious candidate for president, when Congressman Ryan was selected out as a congressman to be the vice presidential nominee, Reince Priebus being the chief of staff to President Trump. These things generally don't get driven by geography in the same way that they were driven earlier in American history, where sort of being from Ohio was considered an important thing. Now, Ohio just isn't that much of a player. I'm sure there'll be future candidates from Wisconsin, but this time around, it doesn't look like it.
All right, Mordecai, thanks as always for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Anytime, Rob. Thank you.
We've been talking to Mordecai Lee, professor of urban planning at UW-Milwaukee, former state lawmaker. He joined us for a look at the growing field of Democratic candidates running for president. Stands now at 20, with former Vice President Joe Biden getting in yesterday. Who do you want to win the presidency in 2020? And what are you looking for in a candidate? What questions do you want to see them asked and get their answers for? What issues are important to you? What characteristics, resume, character, background, comportment, what are you looking for in your next president? Let us know on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up Monday on Central Time, many communities in Wisconsin and around the country rely on volunteer firefighters, but they're often having trouble finding recruits. We'll check out the problem and some possible solutions. A new report from a law firm suggests that there may have been widespread sexual abuse in the Boy Scouts organization. We'll talk to a reporter who's been following that story. And a therapist shares her story of seeking therapy herself and what she learned about humanity along the way. We'll meet the author of the new book, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone. That and a look at some of the top news stories of the day, as we always do. That's all coming up Monday here on Central Time.